Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I am your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and thank you for joining us and listening in. We are turning to Des Moines during the first half of today's show. Lots happening there. Yesterday, thousands of immigrants and supporters took part in a march in Des Moines. It was a day without immigrants to call attention to what immigrants mean to Iowa and to the United States and their role in our society. The Day Without Immigrants was a national event with rallies and people boycotting school and work across the country. Yesterday, KHOI's reporter Susan Franson called immigrant activist Rick Exner, who's from Ames, because he was at the march in Des Moines and we wanted a description of what was happening there. During the interview, Rick gave the phone to a fellow marcher who was with him, and we hear a charming moment when Susan and that marcher realized they actually knew each other. Turns out that Suemi Rios Sosa, who is from Webster City, had just been interviewed by Susan on Local Talk last week. Small world. So anyway, let's hear their description from yesterday's Des Moines rally.
What's going on there at the Capitol?
We're getting ready to move west toward the Capitol, which is about three blocks from here. People are honking. There are signs up. La gente unida, the people united. My parents pay more taxes than your president. Little guy holding that one. And lots of American flags.
What is this event called?
Day Without Immigrants. I'm going to give you Suemi.
Hi, Suemi. Good to talk to you again.
Yes, I was like, Susan, I know her.
I just want to have a little explanation of what's happening there today. How many people are there demonstrating?
The radio stations were saying about 1,000 to 1,500 people would be showing up.
Wow.
Yeah, it started smaller, but there's a lot of us here.
Now, are these people staying away from their jobs today?
I know a lot of Hispanic businesses are closing. Some American businesses are closing. I had to work, and I told my boss that I would be missing work. And so I know.
Is there a response from people driving by?
Yeah. We get a lot of people honking at us or, you know, waving their hands out. Or we get a lot of big truck semis and people honk at us to support.
Are the police friendly and helping you?
The police, I think they're doing a good job. They're helping out. Hold on. Yes, Rick wants to say something.
The Latino students in Nevada are not going to school today. They sent a letter to the Nevada schools this morning explaining why. It takes a lot of courage to come out here today, and it takes a lot of courage not to go to school today. When you're a kid and you don't want more attention drawn to you, and you're already being bullied, and maybe you're a parent, and maybe you're not documented, and you're scared stiff, but people are out here today. They're doing the finest thing that a citizen could ever do. You know, in Iowa, undocumented immigrants pay $50 to $70 million in state taxes every year. That's just the undocumented immigrants, and $60 to $80 million in federal taxes and Social Security taxes, which, of course, they're not collecting a penny on.
We do support to the economy. We're not just taking. Like, you know, we pay 5% of taxes to Social Security, you know. We never get it back because you can't get Social Security unless you have a valid Social Security number. But you can pay into it. The employers are required to take Social Security taxes, and they do. You don't have to have a Social Security number for them to take your taxes out.
So undocumented immigrants nationally are recognized for paying 5% of our Social Security debt.
Well, now, if they're undocumented, how do you know they're paying Social Security?
This was a study done by the Iowa Policy Institute, and it's about 10 years old now, so it's probably conservative. And you can just drive down many main streets in small towns in Iowa and see how they have saved the main street because of the stores and the people on the street buying. They're making a great contribution to our economy here. If this contribution were not being made, we'd be a poor country in many ways. Anyway, I'll give you back to Suemi.
Okay. Are there any other things besides the taxes that people should know about a day without immigrants?
We do make a difference. You know, there will be lots of empty seats at school, or that we will be missed at work if we're not here. And the point is that people take us into consideration. We are part of the community, and when part of the community is missing, you know, it does affect everyone in the community, not just immigrants.
This is Local Talk, and that was Sue Emmy Galrio Sosa from Webster City and Rick Exner from Ames reporting on yesterday's Day Without Immigrants. This was a national day of action when immigrants and supporters boycotted work and school throughout the country in response to the president's crackdown on immigration. Rick and Sue Emmy were outside the state capitol in Des Moines. The Des Moines Register reported that about 2,500 people attended that demonstration. Meanwhile, inside the Capitol, yesterday, the Iowa legislature dramatically scaled back collective bargaining in union contract negotiations for the state's public workers. Iowa has about 184,000 public employees. Only Republicans voted in favor of the legislation, and this came after 3 days of contention and debate and various unsuccessful attempts by Democrats to amend the two bills, one in the Senate and one in the State House, that were introduced by Republicans on February 7. One large group of public employees was the Iowa teachers. To help us understand what happened, we contacted the Iowa State Education Association. Melissa Peterson is with us by phone, and she is their government relations specialist. Thank you for joining us, Melissa. We're speaking to you in Des Moines. Is that correct?
That is correct.
The Iowa State Education Association is a union. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And as I understand it, you represent teachers and other licensed professional staff, school support staff workers, retired workers, and area education agency employees, as well as community college faculty and future teachers.
Yeah, that is correct.
You had people in Des Moines the last week during this struggle at the Capitol?
We did. We had an incredible turnout of not only education professionals, but all kinds of public employees for a public hearing held in the House chamber on Monday evening. I believe the security personnel at the Capitol logged over 4,600 people coming into the Capitol after 3 p.m. on Monday. And then after contract hours ended for our school district employees, many of them joined us at the Capitol for late night debates throughout the week.
I hear that the debate on Wednesday went all night. Is that correct?
That is correct. We ended debate in the House at approximately 10:30 and then headed over to the Senate that went all night long. And I am proud to say that my president, Dr. Tammy Warrow, and my executive director, Mary Jane Cobb, stayed up all night to monitor the debate in the Senate.
So tell us what happened. Before we do that, it's been said that this bill was proposed behind closed doors. Can you explain what that means?
I can only explain what I heard Senator Jason Schultz say, because we were not allowed to be a part of those closed-doors conversations. Yes, we do believe that this bill was modeled heavily after Act 10 in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
And, that they received basically kind of a cookie-cutter piece of legislation produced by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a conservative think tank and research organization. And They did not seek any input from public employees when they were constructing this language, and that as they moved forward with the bill very quickly, by the way, we did not have a chance to have any sort of input on the bill itself. After the language had been drafted, we attempted to contact Republican legislators in both the House and the Senate and didn't have an opportunity to address any of our concerns. And I have to say we were very disappointed, not only in the lack of response that they provided to those of us that work at the Capitol every day, but also to our membership. We had thousands of emails and phone calls of folks, not only with our association, but all public employee associations that reached out and tried to explain what was wrong with the legislation as it was originally drafted. And the responses were disappointing, to say the least.
Now, there are two bills. One was Senate File 213 in the House, and House File 291 in the House. Can you explain exactly, now these bills were passed yesterday, can you tell exactly what these bills do?
Yeah, what they did is they passed two mirror image bills and then substituted the Senate file for the House file. So the dismantling of Chapter 20 bill that was actually passed and that will likely be signed by the governor in the near future is House File 291, but they were the exact same bills. And what this bill does is basically rolls back 40 years of cooperation between state government employees and local employees, local public employees, and we think is terrible in terms of offering an opportunity for public employees to have a conversation with management about everything from their working conditions to evaluation procedures to transfer procedures. It's Yeah, no, it is. It's a terribly unfortunate piece of legislation that unfortunately is going to, in our opinion, do a lot to stifle the cooperation and collaboration that happens at a lot of these local government levels.
Specifically, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that under legislation, most public sector union contracts negotiations will be limited only to base wages, and unions will be banned from negotiating with their employers over issues such as health insurance, evaluation, staff reductions, leave of absences.
Yes, that is correct. So the only mandatory subject of bargaining now under House File 291 will be base wages. And any other subjects, there's actually quite an extensive list of topics that are now categorized as prohibited. And we won't have an opportunity to talk about those things unless we can sit down and get an agreement with management. Regarding the health insurance piece, I think there's quite a bit of misinformation. What's really unfortunate is some of the Republicans have been suggesting that they have to provide a health insurance plan, and that is no longer the case. Now, local districts will only have to offer access to a health insurance plan. So we are very concerned about the implications that might have for our employees.
What do you think was the most central issue for Republicans? Was it the cost of health insurance?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the Republican talking points, both before, during, and even after passage of this bill, they seem to talk about how there needs to be more accountability and transparency for taxpayers, and how currently districts were acting as some sort of ATM. But when there was actually a fiscal note requested by the nonpartisan, or requested to the nonpartisan legislative service agency, which produces a lot of the money-based documents or fiscal notes for bills, there is not a cost savings to the taxpayer. And we've got to remember, too, these public employees who have just lost substantial rights under this new piece of legislation are also taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
So there will not be a considerable amount of cost savings. It could not be quantified, frankly, by the fiscal note put out by LSA. All they could do was say that there would be, frankly, an additional expenditure of almost $200,000 to the Public Employee Relations Board because of the upgrades they will have to do under this new system. So at the end of the day, we think this bill, frankly, was just about taking away rights of public employees and intended to union bust. There are some provisions in here that do nothing, again, to bring any accountability or transparency, but frankly just seem to go out of their way to make it more difficult for public employees to be able to organize and have a voice at the table.
The Republicans have said that this rectifies what amounts to favoritism for unions at taxpayers' expense, and that public employers are hamstrung by union-negotiated employment requirements and need more flexibility to manage the workforce.
Yeah, I find it difficult to understand how two mutually agreed-upon parties can be hamstrung by one another. The way that the system currently works before this bill was that literally people got to sit down at the table across from one another, right? You got management on one side, you have public employees on the other side, and they had a mutually agreed upon conversation about what would be best for their employment situation. And in 98% of all of the cases, they voluntarily came to an agreement. And there was a very fair and neutral process to handle those 2% of the cases that did not be, that were not able to come to mutual agreement across the table from one another. So we think that this is just a terribly unnecessary piece of legislation that, in fact, is going to make things more difficult for mutual agreement to be agreed upon.
There's such a big disparity between how the Republicans that voted for this feel about it, and they feel very, very good about it, and how the oppositions, including unions like yours and the Democratic Party, talk about the destructiveness of the bill. And it's hard to imagine politicians just wanting to be unfair. I was wondering, you know, in Wisconsin, you mentioned earlier that this bill is kind of used Wisconsin's bill as a prototype. And one of the results in Wisconsin, especially with the teachers union being a relatively strong union, has been that it has greatly reduced the union's ability to organize for the Democratic Party. And I was wondering whether you think this kind of dynamic is going on in Iowa, where there's really an interest in consolidating the ability of the Republican Party to, you know, continue in the future as a party.
Well, I think, I'm sorry, there are lots of things in that statement that I would like to unpack if we could
for
one moment. I think it's important to highlight that not all Republicans were entirely supportive of this legislation. We actually had 6 Republicans in the House who chose to vote against the final bill. And I would note that those 6 Republicans, 2 of them are former educators, and the other 2 were former peace officers or public safety officers.
Mm-hmm. One was from Alamosa, right, where the correction facility
yes.
is?
Yep. And then there were two additional folks who, for reasons I have not yet determined, decided not to vote in support of this bill, but were appreciative that they took the time to listen to their constituents. We know when you look at the bill registrations or lobbyist declarations on a bill, so people have to know whether they're in support, not in support, or if they're neutral, that they were overwhelmingly lobbyists and organizations who were registered against or in opposition to this bill. The only three organizations that spoke in favor during the committee process, one was the Iowa Taxpayers Association, one was the Associated, Building and General Contractors Association, and the other was Americans for Prosperity, which is an organization that's funded by the Koch brothers. And these individuals did not have much to say in support of the bill, only said that they were in favor of the bill and then excused themselves from the committee process. So we know that there is a political motivation, frankly, for a lot of Republicans to move this legislation. And in fact, remarks were made during late night debate in the Senate yesterday, saying specifically that they were going after and targeting the two largest unions, AFSCME and ISCA, with this legislation. Now, the difference between ISCA, or rather Iowa's association, and the Wisconsin Teachers Association is that Iowa is a right-to-work state. So we know that all of our members that voluntarily pay dues want to be a part of our association. That wasn't the case in Wisconsin. They were not a right-to-work state. They were an agency fee state, so everyone had to be a part of the union. Mm-hmm. That's how we're different. When it comes down to the political side of things, again, it's really hard not to think that this was just going after our organizations who, yes, traditionally have been large supporters of people who, in our case, are pro-public education and pro-labor rights, traditionally been Democrats.
We're speaking with Melissa Peterson. She's with the Iowa State Education Association, the Teachers Union in Iowa. Melissa, one more question before we finish. You mentioned that this has been seen as a union-busting move on the part of the legislature. And as I understand it, this bill makes it impossible for the union to automatically deduct union dues from people's paychecks. And it does exclude you from any significant arbitration. So has this busted the union? What happens now to the teachers union?
I can tell you it has not busted our union. We have existed for over 160 years, and ISCA will continue to exist. We've actually had an increase in membership since this bill was originally filed, and I think it's because people are very scared. They're very nervous, and they want to make sure that they have an organization that helps to empower them and make sure that they still have a voice in this conversation. So ISCA is going to continue to fight on behalf of all of our incredible education professionals across the state, and make sure that they do still have a voice in this conversation.
So, and you think that's possible under the circumstances?
It's going to look different, but yes, it's very possible. It's very possible, and we know that this is just the beginning of the fight. This is not the end of the fight, but we are going to continue to stand up for our incredible public educators.
Okay. Any specific ways that that can be done under the circumstances?
Yes, we still think that there's going to be an opportunity to make sure that we have a voice in the local conversation. Just because something no longer is mandated by law doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to try to have the conversations. I think it's important to point out that in the 8 days that it's taken them to move this piece of legislation so quickly through the legislative process, we've settled over 140 contracts. So we know that there is management on the side of local districts that are also very nervous.
We're concerned. One more question. Is this unusual in terms of states in the United States? Are we at the exception now, or is this something that's happened a lot of different places?
We do think we're the exception. Many of the provisions in this bill actually only apply to two other states, Wisconsin mm-hmm. and Nevada, who, by the way, have also lost educators.
Are you worried about teachers leaving Iowa?
There is a concern that we are going to lose educators potentially to Minnesota and to Illinois in particular mm-hmm. if they can offer better packages mm-hmm. for educators. But I think what I'm more concerned about is the competition that's going to be set up between rural and urban areas. Mm-hmm. They're going to have urban areas who can frankly pay more and rural areas that won't be able to afford. So I think that's going to be an unintended consequence that the Republicans did not consider.
Okay, well, Melissa, it's a big topic. We'll end here for today. Thank you so much for your time, and we probably need to check back in a few months and see how things are shaking down. We're speaking with Melissa Peterson from the Iowa Teachers Union, the Iowa State Education Association. She's their government relations specialist. Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All Blues by Miles Davis, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. And speaking of schools, Kathy Hansen is here from the Ames Community School District. Kathy is Director of School Community and Media Relations and comes once in a month to bring news from Ames Schools. Kathy, you brought a whole group of special guests with you today from the Ames Middle School. The Social Justice Council is a student-run group that stands up for everybody's rights. Kathy, would you please introduce them?
I'll let them say their names, but I just want to tell you that I have Steph Scherz here, who is the adult a faculty sponsor of this group, and I have four students who are going to tell you why they joined this group and what they hope to accomplish.
So let's start that way. You want to start at the end of the table there? Tell us who you are. And now you're the leadership of this group. You're a leadership team. So tell us who you are and what you're doing in this group.
My name is Pariksha Sarda, and I joined this group because I wanted everyone to have a safe environment where they can be who they want to be and they don't have to be judged by everyone.
My name is Jason Vernon, and I'm one of the leaders of the group, and I joined because, kind of the same as Pariksha, I just wanted everybody to have like a safe environment, and I saw a lot of injustice around our school, and I needed that to stop.
I'm Olivia Reed. I'm also one of the co-leaders. I joined Social Justice Council because I saw it as an amazing opportunity to help Ames Middle School, and there are just so many things going on that I don't think kids realize what they actually are, and if I can do anything to spread awareness about those things, then I will.
I'm Malik Davis. I joined this group because I saw lots of just really sad things happening in the political world and in our school, and I really just wanted to make a stop to it.
Okay, so I'm really struck by almost all of you said that you are part of this group, partly because you've seen things at your school. Could each of you maybe describe what it is actually that you're talking about, that you've seen that has motivated you to take action?
Well, I've seen that people use the word racist way too much. They call every single thing racist. They don't need a reason. They just call it racist. It's stupid. So people need to learn what that word actually means.
And Jason?
There's a lot of kind of hidden bullying at our school, like that maybe nobody would notice. Like if it's just like simple name calling or like someone trying to be funny, but then it just turns into some type of bullying.
Can you give an example of a name-calling that happens?
Well, like, I'm usually called short because, well, I am short. There may be, like, racist name comments.
At our school, a lot of kids do what they call roasting, which is supposed to be funny, mean comments that go back and forth, and sometimes there's even roast battles, which can end up being really offensive. And although sometimes they start when both people say they want to do a roast battle, but it can also start just from a person being picked on or for whatever reason, like whether they're short or tall, or it doesn't matter, they find something different or strange about them, and they just tear them down on that one simple thing.
They're emulating roasting that happens on television?
I think, yeah, a lot of those things are based on what they see in the media on television.
Malik?
I found that lots of times, like Jason said, it's like underlining. For instance, people will throw in the term gay and using it as a jovial manner and, I guess, trying to be funny, and there's an underlining sense of, like, you're different, and we're going to make jokes about that. Once you say, I'm not really comfortable with that, you're kind of made as, like, an outlier, and you just can't take a joke. I do experience sometimes students feel like they can't express their feelings, or people will judge them because it's, I guess, a smaller school, and so lots of people know people, and things, I guess, travel around quickly.
So there's social pressure. Yeah, and we're talking about the Ames Middle School here. I spoke a little while back with a Hispanic member of the middle school, and they said they were sometimes called tacos. Have you heard that?
I've heard lots of racial slurs. Some people think that because they have a friend of a certain race, they're allowed privileges, I guess, to say certain things and use them in, I guess, a jovial manner, and it makes up for it. And they, like, hide behind that facade, which allows them, I guess, to have these, like, racial views and hate, I guess.
Okay, so, guys, so what is the solution?
There really is no solution except to tell people what it's really all about. Because you can't fix everyone. But if you fix a couple people and you tell them what it means and you try to help, then it can make a big difference.
And yeah. What do you tell them?
Things like, you know, that's wrong. You need to understand what you're saying. Because people don't understand what it means. They just say it, thinking that it's funny. And that's something that needs to be changed.
So one of your solutions is to speak up.
Yeah, to spread awareness.
Jason, were you going to say something?
To spread awareness, really, like I just said. Because a lot of the times, as I said earlier, there's bullying that's, like, not seen, or someone could accidentally bully someone, I guess. Like, they don't know they're doing it. So by spreading awareness, we can even, like, get that to stop, because then people would notice that more, be like, hey, that wasn't cool. Like, I shouldn't have said that. Mm-hmm. And then...
Does that happen? Does it happen that you point it out and somebody goes, oh, I have to think about that?
Yeah, for the members of the Social Justice Council, it does, because we all kind of know that we have been a bully at one point. Like, we have said some things that we probably shouldn't have said. And so everybody that comes to the Social Justice Council, I guess, kind of gets that right away, and they see how they can stop.
This is a self-awareness program. Those of you who are joining this group are learning yourselves to make these distinctions.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Olivia, you have any comments?
I think it's very important that the people who are attacking or bullying, that they know that they're hurting the actual person's feelings, and it's not just us who think it's wrong, but it's actually their friends. And I think it's important for them to hear it from their friends. And Social Justice Council, I think, can help those people's friends. Like, hey, it's okay to tell your friends that you don't think what they said was right. Or to build people's courage to talk to their friends and stand up to their friends if they think that what they said was wrong.
Malik?
I agree with them all. I think lots of times it's based on our age, because we're in, I guess, a weird age where we want to fit in, but we want to be different. And it's, I think, based in ignorance and people not understanding that words have a large history and are very effective, and they can be used as aggressive tools. And people want to be included in, I guess, cliques and be friends with everyone. And I think when it comes to that education and teaching people that these are hurtful, and hoping that they put that off into their, that they bring that into their adult life, is really important. Because if we can't, as students, instill that in other students, then I think we need to be changing something.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of other people's opinions, what do people think of the fact that you've started this group? Go ahead, Malik.
In the beginning, there was, I guess, some pushback, just because I think people like to be quote-unquote cool, and having an injustice council that talks about issues that people are dealing with on a daily basis and are, I guess, could possibly be inflicting is a little bit of, like, a reality check, and saying, like, hey, just because we're students, we understand that this is going on and we have to address it. And I guess people thought it wasn't cool enough. But I just think it's people afraid because they don't know how to use their voice and how mm-hmm. to be effective with it.
And you're willing to deal with that?
Yeah.
Okay. We're speaking with members of the Social Justice Council, a student-run group at the Ames Middle School. And Steph Shares is the staff sponsor for this group who made this possible. Steph, how was this group created?
So this group was created for the students to be run by the students. I am the staff sponsor, but I've been an educator for 12 years, and I know students often need a space. They have things on their heart and their minds that they don't get to speak about in class, and that in my mind are more important sometimes than what's covered in class. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to give them that space.
Tell us a little bit how the process was of getting the group started.
I basically said to my principal, hey, can I start this group? She said, go for it.
And how did you find the members of the group?
It started a little bit small. We just put it in the announcements, and the first few times we had maybe 10, 12 people. And then as we elected leadership, this leadership team you see here is what really drove participation. Now we're probably, what would you say, 35 that we had at the last meeting. We didn't have enough chairs, right? So when I was driving membership, you know, I was getting 10, 12. When they started talking to their friends and going out into the hallways and lunchrooms and homerooms and saying, join this group, it's important, then you see the result. Then we get the 35.
Huh. So what happens during a meeting?
Do you guys want to say what we do during the meetings?
So usually Olivia and I have a slideshow up, and it always says the first thing, circle up. So we get in a circle. And then from there, we introduce ourselves and say something like maybe why we came here or what injustices we see or something similar to those lines. And then we get started. Usually we have a discussion, but more recently we've been working on recruitment ideas and making posters and writing scripts.
We've also been working on a new contest. It's a creative contest, so AMS students can turn in a short story, a poetry, or some kind of visual media in honor of Black History Month.
We're also hosting an African-American read-in, which will be everyone coming into the library and reading some of their favorite African-American authors. It's having those little events, contests, read-ins, things like that help spread awareness of Social Justice Council, but also Black History Month and what that means. And I think just having those little things or seeing a poster about that can help people think about that.
Yeah. And the contest is another way to, like, give those kids a voice so that they can say, like, this is where I'm coming from, this is my experiences, and then they can write about it or make a piece of art.
Are you getting good results? Are you getting feedback from folks in the group that something is working for them?
What really filled my heart and made me feel like this is so worth it was a student a couple weeks ago when we were going around the circle and people were saying, why do you come to this? Why do you come to Social Justice Council? And I remember a student said, because I know I belong here and I won't get judged here. This is the only place I can be myself. I don't know if you guys remember. And I was just like, yeah, that's why we have this.
Describe a little bit more what the experience is like for you, Steph, to run this group.
The experience is like seeing my replacements lining up behind me. The experience is also inspiring. I love the time that I get to spend with these students because they fill me with hope. I know that someone's caring about the future. And I've told you guys how many times, like, it's so cool that you care. And I'm glad that Malik spoke to saying that it is uncool sometimes in middle school to be sensitive, to care about things. But to me, that's all it is. If you're not caring, what are you doing? And so to see these students care about something, it's why I teach.
Mm-hmm. How do your parents feel about this group and what you're doing?
My parents think it's a really good idea. We actually had a lot of discussions yesterday when we were eating dinner, so it was pretty cool.
What were you discussing?
We were just talking about how people seem to realize differences, but they don't think that those can make us stronger. I think people need to realize that differences will make us stronger, not weaker, because if everyone's the same, nothing can change.
Mm-hmm. Jason, how do your parents feel?
They think it's pretty cool. They're like, they love how I am actually doing something and, like, making those, like, differences, I guess.
My parents are also very supportive of it. Yeah, they also think it's cool that I, having a background in theater, I feel very comfortable talking in front of big people, and sometimes I don't have the opportunity to use that, I guess, talent, if you will, for a lot other things besides theater. And being a part of the leadership team means, like, I can use that. I can use my, I guess, not stage fright in front of other people to spread the word about something I'm very passionate about. And it's really exciting, and my parents are excited for me.
So it's a growing experience for you. It's an experience for you to develop your skills.
Well, I come from a biracial household, so I guess I'm kind of put into the mix of, like, experiencing differences. And so I think it was really enlightening for my parents to see that I understand them, and I understand the, like, I guess, disparity and the differences that people have to face. And so me taking action and bringing to light and not wanting to, like, I guess, cower and not talk about it was really nice for them, because they've experienced lots of racism in their relationship, and just seeing me be able to be so open about it was really nice for them.
So your parents have been worried about what experiences you have as a biracial student?
Yeah. They used to live in a small town, and so it was, I guess, a little more close-minded people, and they've always just wanted me to strive to succeed and, I guess, not look at that so much, but always know that I will have that and I need to just, like, go away from that and just be my own person.
Do you feel like this group is helping you get the skills to accomplish what you need to do to kind of grow into this situation?
I think this group is amazing, and just the people and the community and the relationship that we've built is just really encouraging to me and so many other students about we all are different, and no matter what, we stand together as students.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steph, any last words about this group? What you think the future is of this group and what you think it can accomplish?
My last words on this group would be Parents, if you have a student this age and you're listening, please listen to your student. They have a lot to say. And I have a joke. Sometimes I think to myself, what if I just stopped talking? And consider that with your student. What if you just stopped talking and listened to what your student has to say? You might be surprised.
One of your main goals here is to listen and hear what is on people's minds at the middle school in terms of the young people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that she does listen to you?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank Absolutely. You. We've been speaking with the Social Justice Council at the Ames Middle School. Steph Shares is the teacher who has been sponsoring this group. And Kathy Hansen is here. She's from the Ames School District. She brought the group to us. Thank you, as part of your monthly check-in from the school. Kathy, one question for you that was asked by one of our listeners in terms of the Social Justice Club and in general the idea of racial equality or diversity at the school. There was a question about why there was not more attention paid to this at the recent school board meeting, since this has been raised in the press as well as an issue at the middle school. Your thoughts on why this has not been addressed more by the school board itself?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question, but I can say that this isn't something that the district suddenly became aware of. A lot of times the staff and the board are working on everything they can do to make sure every student has a chance to succeed. But the issue, I believe they're talking about the achievement gap.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the achievement gap between minority students and regular students. I think all this is just sort of coming together and reaching critical mass to where we can respond and tell what we're doing to address this. And it's myriad things that we're doing. And rest assured, the school board does support the staff. You won't always hear that in a school board meeting that has many things on the agenda. But just keep in touch and watch for what we will be letting the community know that we're doing. This is one example. Mm-hmm. Some things are formal, policy-type things. Some things are the school community is taking action. There are things going on in every school building that are looking at the ways that we can provide everyone a voice and everyone have equity so that the strategies we put in place actually have a chance to impact each student. So mm-hmm.
This is a system being put in place where the voices of the young people themselves can be heard, which is explicitly meant for that. So it's happening on a lot of different levels.
Right.
And do you feel, Steph, that these voices will be heard all the way up through the system?
Well, we haven't yet made it to a school board meeting, Social Justice Council, but that's something that if our leadership team wants to take on, I think it would be very powerful. I also wanted to add that I do feel that all students are regular students.
You really are getting support from the middle school for doing this. Thank you so much, Kathy. Any last words?
There is tremendous support from the staff and the school board to look at everything we can do for all of our students in these areas that include social justice, mm-hmm. racial equity. We can't just live in the past, can't stay there. We are moving forward, and it takes small steps, but we have tremendous support at every level to take those steps. It's going to take a lot of work. Mm-hmm. We know we have a lot of work to do, but we're doing it.
Thank you so much. Welcome back to Local Talk. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and that was Al Jarreau with Compared to What? Al died last Sunday at the age of 76. And did you know that he was a University of Iowa alum? While he was studying for a master's degree, he got his start as a musician in the 1960s in Cedar Rapids, where he worked for the late Joe Abodili's band at the Tender Trap, a bar that was considered one of Iowa's top jazz clubs at the time. Alex Fafar is here from the Ames History Center. Welcome back, Alex. And speaking of African-American history, what do you have for us?
Yeah, we're going to talk about a gentleman here that is maybe not as well-known as he used to be around town, J. Herman Banning. He was one of an early pioneer black flyer here and actually lived in Ames for a short time. I'm going to start by telling a little fun story about that, and then we'll get a little bit into some of Herman's background. But take you back to 1928, October 4th. It was the Story County Diamond Jubilee celebrating its 75th anniversary, and Ames decided to have an air show to show it off, and Herman was one of the pilots, and he was flying another Ames local resident's brand-new airplane, and unfortunately, his plane spun out of control, and this is down kind of south of town. There used to be an airport on the end of 69 down there, 2 miles south of Ames, and unfortunately, he kind of had a little mishap with the plane, and it went down near the Kate Mitchell School. Well, everyone started running down Highway 69. This is Farwell Brown was telling this story. So him and a bunch of kids started taking off down the highway, trying to get down there as fast as they could to see the wreckage, to see what happened to Herman. And everyone came up upon the scene thinking surely that there was no way he could have survived that. But miraculously, he had straightened out the plane and managed to land it with only a few broken ribs and a bunch of painful lacerations, I'm sure. But he was able to survive it. So that's kind of his farrowing heat kind of in Ames here. But Herman was actually born in Oklahoma, and his family moved to Ames in 1919 when he entered Iowa State College to study engineering, which is pretty amazing. Still pretty early African-American student at Iowa State. Remember, George Washington Carver came in the 1890s, but there weren't a lot of – they were pretty sparse, let's say. So it's cool to see him come out. But he said that first year of school, that's when he became, and I quote Herman – he became air-minded. He started thinking about flight. It really got him interested as a boy. And so he tried to go to flying schools in Chicago, Minneapolis, Kansas City, St. Louis, but they all rejected him, unfortunately. So he befriended a white Army officer in Des Moines, Lieutenant Raymond Fisher, and he started driving down the 30 miles to Des Moines. He gets some instructions, and that lasted for about 5 months when he was learning how to fly down in Des Moines. Now, Herman also, being a pilot at that time, he started an auto garage in 1922 here in Ames at about North 2nd Street, kind of south of the tracks there. And I have a feeling that's where he got into a lot of his tinkering and really started to develop some of his mechanical skills for working on airplanes. But he managed to live in Ames, after he opened up his auto shop, he started making a lot of his money doing barnstorming here around town. And that,
it's still a pretty big leap from auto mechanics to barnstorming.
Yeah, but that was a lot of what they did. I mean, these guys were pulling from, you know, things that were already there. They were working on, you know, car engines that were just starting to develop. They were taking those, or motorcycle engines, taking them out of cars, out of motorcycles,
and putting them in airplanes.
Yeah, so especially these early pilots, I think they developed a lot of skills and ideas from the motorcycle industry that was really just starting to take off at that
good
point.
Good old days when you could put a motorcycle engine in an airplane and yeah, fly it around.
Exactly, yeah. No permit, no license, just take off and come back down. Hmm. Yeah, so Herman, he made a lot of his money stunt piloting, so he'd do like those air shows. He'd travel around, they'd pay him some cash to go do some barrel rolls and things like that. He also flew politicians and entertainers and other dignitaries for a fee also, including Illinois Congressman Oscar DePreis, who was the first African-American to serve in the Congress since the Civil War. So that was one of his guys that he would take around. Being in Illinois, he'd probably fly from Des Moines and Illinois back and forth.
Wow.
Herman is also credited with, in 1926, they set up an official licensing system for pilots. And he was the first African-American to sign up for the pilot's license. So they're kind of, for a while, he was dubbed as the first African-American flyer. There are a couple earlier ones that have been discovered in more recent history, but he definitely gets the first for signing up, first name on the list.
Interesting. So it raises the question, obviously the Ames Municipal Airport wasn't in existence in those days. So where did people keep their airplanes?
No. A lot of times he worked a lot out of Wilfred Jerbrock's air flight, which Wilfred was also the brother of Joe Jerbrock. If maybe a lot of you went to the movies in the 50s and 60s, you went to his movie theaters. Joe was also into flying, but they kind of set up their own place down there in a hangar, and you could kind of rent some space, I think, to leave a plane. But this kind of points out he was also, if any of you are familiar with Nita Snook, they're kind of around the same time period, around 1920.
And who was that?
Nita Snook was a woman pioneer aviator. She was the first woman to get her federal license.
Transition into women's history.
Exactly, yeah. And she went to Ames High, born and raised here, and she's the one that eventually taught Amelia Earhart how to fly. But these two were kind of concurrent. And I know Nita she kind of took off where Hilton Coliseum was. That little grassy floodplain was her airport, quote-unquote airport. But I think Herman did most of his stuff down at the Jerbrock Airport and stuff like that. But yeah, Municipal Airport didn't come around until about 43 during World War II when flight was really – they were doing training programs and it was really picking up. So they needed an official airport at that point.
Okay. Well, thank you. Anything else about this aviator?
He did some other cool stuff. He did kind of flying around Ames for a while. In 29, he left. This is shortly a year after his crash at the Story County Diamond Jubilee. He took off, went out to Los Angeles, and did. He worked for it was an Aero Club, so they were paid to go and do shows and things like that. And this was actually an all black Aero Club that was founded in Los Angeles. And kind of from that, the Depression hits. That kind of falls apart. And all of a sudden, he's flying around with some people, and he hears about a $1,000 prize for the first black pilot to fly transcontinental. So Banning and his mechanic, Thomas C. Allen, say, hey, I think we can do that. They buy for $450, they buy a secondhand airplane, and they leave in September of 1932 with a full tank of gas and $25 in cash, trying to make it all the way from Los Angeles to New York.
$25 in cash.
$25 in cash, yeah. Remember, gas was 29 cents a gallon at that point. So it went a little farther than today. But they it's not enough to make it all the way across the country. In fact, they called themselves flying hobos because they had to earn their way as they went. So wow. I know they picked up a lot of support from African-American churches in Oklahoma, which is where he was originally from. And a great story, when they were almost to the end of the leg, they were in Philadelphia staying at the YMCA trying to save a few bucks, and they ran into a gentleman there that had 150,000 campaign bills for the Democratic Party that year. It was Roosevelt and Garner, and they paid them not only their trip to New York, but also their trip all the way back to California if they would throw those handbills out all over Philadelphia during the Democratic National Convention. So they just littered the Philadelphia with Roosevelt Garner handbills. So that's kind of a fun little story. So they completed it, and they were the first African Americans to make the transcontinental journey across the United States. It's an amazing feat. Sadly, though,
that's a great story.
It is a wonderful story, and a fun little thing. He had a little plane nicknamed Miss Ames, and it was just a little two-seater plane that he would do a lot of his stunting in and take dignitaries on trips. This is while he was still living in Ames, but it's just kind of a fun little reminder, and it'll draw back to his Iowa State years.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Little Miss Ames.
Yeah, and I believe that was on display at the National. National Space and Air Museum with the Smithsonian for quite a while. At least when Farwell was writing about it in the mid-90s, it was on display there.
Yeah. So we have a photograph of this gentleman?
Yes, we do. We have a couple that are from a couple other universities and stuff that we have access to. There's one, a nice shot of him with his plane. It says, Miss Ames, fly with Banning.
And the photograph can be seen at your website?
Yeah, we can get that, yeah, on our website. And it's also linked to the Ames Public Library Farwell T. Brown photographic archive, which is also linked through our AmesHistory.org website.
AmesHistory.org. And this is Alex Bafar from the Ames History Center. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Great story. Great story. African-American history in aviation in Ames. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And this has been Local Talk on KHY Community Radio. I've been your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Today we also heard from the Social Justice Club at the middle school. And a number of students, Preksha Sarda, Malik Davis, Jason Vernon, Olivia Reed with their staff sponsor, Steph Shares, and Kathy Hansen, Director of School Community and Media Relations from Ames Community School District. We also heard from Melissa Peterson from the Iowa State Education Association and immigrants activists Eric Exner and Sue Emmy Calrio Sosa, immigrant resident and activist from Webster City. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from the CD A Ballad of Kate Shelley. Our engineer today was Evan Taylor. Thank you, Evan. And remember that Local Talk is archived at khoifm.org, where you also find links to the people and issues we've talked about on the radio show today. Remember that KHOI is streamed live at khoifm.org. Thank you for listening. Remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. We appreciate you listening, and we will see you again on the radio. Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the award-winning National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu. That's center.iastate.edu.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.